Cheryl, thank you. Thanks for having us. This is amazing for us to get to be here.
Well, thank you for coming. I don't want to upset your audience, but it's kind of rainy and cold in California today.
I was a little surprised by that, right? I wanted sunny. Wanted sunny Cali. But hey, could you tell us your story? Could you tell us how you got here? You're in a pretty influential spot. You are the COO of Facebook, 35,000 associates. Tell us how you got here.
Well, I grew up in Miami, Florida. My father was a doctor. My mother was community activist and teacher. And I actually never thought I'd work in a business.
Yeah, I've heard you say that. That they were not...
They were not pro-business.
That's right.
They were not pro-business. They've come along. But, you know, being a doctor was a good thing. Mm-hmm. Being a volunteer, working
people.
In a nonprofit. That's right. Mm-hmm. But I went into the government. Mm-hmm. After I graduated from college, I actually went to the World Bank. I worked on leprosy in India.
Wow.
Which is as kind of challenging an experience as I had had, at least at that point. And then I went into the government. And then what I saw kind of sitting in D.C., I was at the Treasury Department mm-hmm. in the Clinton presidency, was technology. And technology seemed like it was just changing things and very mission-based. And so I came all the way out here. I went to Google. I was there for almost 6.5 years, and then I came to Facebook.
And you started at Google. You had 4 employees on your team, and it grew to 4,000 in your tenure there?
Well, yes, my team did, and the company grew to 20,000.
Yeah, I still couldn't even believe that. But so you've been here for...
almost 11 years. I want to say 11 years in just a few weeks.
Wow. Well, congratulations and thank you. I love the mission of Facebook is to create communities.
That's right.
And it's really similar to what the church does.
No, that's right. And it wasn't the original mission. So Facebook's 15 years old. And the original mission was to help people share and give people the power to share and connect. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, way into our history, over a year ago, Mark really had a chance, our founder, to think about what it meant to connect. And he decided that connection wasn't enough. Connection was great.
Yep.
But it's really about what we do with those connections and building community. So we did something not a lot of companies do, which is we changed our mission. And the mission is now explicitly about building community. And I do think that's what a lot of faith-based organizations do, because I think both at the worst moments of our lives and some of the best moments of our lives, and even just the daily, mundane moments of our lives, we are better when we're not alone. And whether that's connection to faith, so we don't feel alone, whether that's connection to someone who's leading us in worship. I know you do that for so many people around the country. Or whether that's connection to the person who lives next door, the person who lives across the world with whom we share something. It is those connections that I think help us get through, bring out the best in us. And that is our mission.
Well, you guys have made the world smaller in a lot of ways. But you've become famous probably for reasons that you definitely wouldn't have intended. You wrote a book called Option B. This book, I've got to say, is fantastically written. I'm sure that getting to write it with Adam Grant probably helped. What a phenomenally smart person. But this is your story. Can you tell us a little bit about why you wrote it and the circumstances that surrounded you writing it?
Yeah, so I wrote a book before that. I never really thought I'd be a writer, but I actually found I love to write. I wrote a book called Lean In about women and equality. And then years later, and 2015, my husband died very, very suddenly. We had 2 young children, 7 and 10 at the time. And I think for me, the processing of that, I took to what I had realized I loved years before, which is I started writing a journal and it eventually became a book. And when my husband first died, I asked Adam, he's my psychologist friend, even though, as he said, he's not that kind of psychologist. He's an industrial and organizational psychologist,
had to be so helpful to have someone like that to process this with.
Yeah. But I said, how much strength do I have? How much resilience? And he said, that's the wrong question.
Wow.
Because you're not born with a set amount of resilience. Yep. You build it.
Yep.
And we build it in ourselves and we build it in each other. And this book was me processing and learning with Adam how people get stronger, how people overcome loss and grief and hardship to try to find their way.
I want to read this one section where you define resilience right at the very beginning, but... As I was getting ready for this today, I even thought, do you get tired of talking about this? Because it's not like, you know, I don't know, Billy Joel, Elton John, they play the same hits and they've got to love it. But your story is filled with so much pain. And I can't even imagine what you went through having to tell your children that their father died, that you lost your husband. And to have to go through the process of that being brought up over and over again, how does that sit with you? How do you find even the resilience in yourself to be able to do that on a on a day like this? Is that difficult?
You know, Adam and I have talked about how there's a huge self-help section in every bookstore, but there's not a big help others section.
Wow.
We want our book to be in the help others section. And, you know, there is such a thing. Everyone's heard of post-traumatic stress.
Yep.
Everyone's heard of that.
Yep.
But there is such a thing as called post-traumatic growth.
Yep.
And more people experience post-traumatic growth than post-traumatic stress, but no one's ever heard about it. And what that means is you go through something traumatic and you grow. And one of the ways you grow and become stronger is you try to take that pain and do something with it. And so I think this book was me trying to tell other people what I wish someone was there to tell me and what Adam was there to tell me and try to find some good, some way of honoring Dave's life. I talked to a friend today. Who suddenly lost her husband.
Wow.
And, you know, she never expected it to happen. I never expected it to happen to her or to me. But this book was my way of trying to honor Dave's life and give back. And so, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to think about it and hard to talk about it. But it's not like I don't think about it anyway.
Right.
I think that's one of the core lessons of the book. The core lessons of the book is, in my experience, is kick the elephant out of the room. Before I lost Dave, I would walk into Facebook, walk into work.
Yeah.
Everyone talked to me. Drop my kids off at school. After I lost Dave, there was just silence.
Because they didn't know what to say.
They're afraid to say the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw myself in that. Like I thought about colleagues at work who were going through cancer. Yeah. I would say something one time, I'm so sorry to hear you're sick. And then I would never bring it up again because I was afraid to remind them. You can't remind someone she has cancer. She knows. If you say to me, even almost 4 years later, I'm so sorry for your loss, I don't think, oh, I forgot. What loss? What are you talking about, right? I know. So one of our core messages is kick the elephant out of the room and show up for each other. And I do think that follows what faith does. Church,
Does.
You go to, I mean, you've been to more services than I did. I was raised and I still am Jewish. But when you go to temple, when you go to church, people are talking about the hard stuff.
That's
You're not just talking about the sun is shining today. You are there to talk about life and birth and death and love and God and the hardships. And you are kicking those elephants out of the room and helping people deal with them.
One of the fascinating things, there's so many different elements of your story that you do such a great job communicating. I feel like you've given words to things that I know I've felt, that certainly many people have felt, but they didn't even know what to do with. One of them is what you're talking about, of the awkwardness sometimes of grief. But the other thing I love that you talk about is coming back to work and how challenging that was. I can't even imagine. I mean, I think for, you know, the person that's working the regular 9-to-5 job, that would be difficult. But in your role, carrying the weight of leadership that you carry, how was that process for you in returning to work after losing Dave?
Well, it wasn't easy. And I'll say one thing is, you know, 60% of workers get no bereavement leave. And that's a problem. You know, we had generous bereavement leave before I lost Dave, but we've extended it further. We now give 20 days for immediate family, 10 days for extended family. And I've personally gone around talking to lots of CEOs, and my foundation has too, and we've gotten a lot of people, large companies, small companies, to extend bereavement leave. So for anyone watching who runs a company or has the ability to influence where they work, give people bereavement leave. They need it. But eventually you come back, and for me, coming back was hard. I came back part-time because I wanted to pick my kids up from school every single day, and I did that for many weeks, and then I went full-time again. But coming back was also good because I wanted out of my house, because in my house, and it wasn't that I didn't miss Dave everywhere, but I missed him more in our kitchen where he was more likely to be than at work. So giving me something to do was hugely important. And that is one of the lessons, showing up for friends, kicking the elephant out of the room. Please don't assume that someone who's going through something hard wants to be left alone. They may want to get out. And don't judge. I have stories in here and stories that we researched where people lose people and they show up for work immediately and other people will criticize them.
Yeah.
And there was a story that we had talked to someone. She was like, I couldn't bear to be at home. Work gave me someplace to go. No judgments.
Yeah. So in coming back to work, Mark gave you the freedom to be able to come back when you were ready. And you had to make that decision that all of us have to make. How am I going to process this? Because you couldn't just stuff it and say, I'm never going to deal with this. I mean, part of grief wants us to do that, I think. But we all know that the healthiest leaders are the most emotionally healthy people. And so eventually you had to process that. How did you learn how to do that? How did you learn how to process that in a way that allowed you to become, as you say, an even better leader. You bounced forward, which is one of the chapters that I think is so fantastic as well. How did you do that? How did you process that emotion in a way that made you a healthier person?
Well, I came back 10 days later, the day my kids went to back to school. Mm-hmm. The therapist we talked to said, get them back to school as quickly as you can. It's good for them. So 10 days later, they went back to school when they were ready. Mm-hmm. But it was, I think, very, very good. Mm-hmm. For the same too, like, they have to go to school. Mm-hmm. Get out of the house. They were happy to go back. And when I came back, again, I was not here the longest days. I was here short days for a while. But I would try to get through the meetings, and sometimes I just couldn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just couldn't. My first day back, I fell asleep. I talked too much.
You genuinely fell asleep.
Fell asleep in a meeting in Mark's office. Fell asleep, talked too much. Said that a colleague of mine worked at Google who'd worked at Microsoft. And I know that sounds silly, but in the tech world, that's a big mistake.
Yep.
All in one day. And at the end of the day, I went home and I called Mark and I said, maybe I came home too soon. I made a fool of myself today. Mm-hmm. I cried. Mm-hmm. I slept. Mm-hmm. I talked too much. And he said, no, you didn't. I think you contributed today, and here's how. Mm. And so one thing I never would have understood about coming back to work before this is now, if someone's going through hardship and they come back to work, I go out of my way to point out ways they're doing a good job.
That's great.
Because reassurance I didn't need before, I needed. Someone saying to me, you made a good point today. Mm-hmm. I never would have needed that before, but when that happened right after Dave died, I was like, great. Mm-hmm. I'm not the zombie I feel like. Mm-hmm. I'm not crying. I mean, I am crying all the time, but I did something okay. Mm-hmm. And I needed to hear that. And I know that other people need to hear it too. So I go out of my way. Got to be real. But hey, that was a good point today. Or I'm glad you came back.
Mm. And it allowed you to start rebuilding your confidence.
That's right. And I needed to rebuild. Mm. Because one of the lessons of overcoming grief and overcoming any hardship is the three P's. Personalization, don't blame yourself. Now, there are things that are our fault and we have to forgive ourselves for those. But most of us blame ourselves for things that aren't our fault.
Yeah.
My husband died of cardiovascular disease. I spent so long thinking about how I should have known he had cardiovascular disease. It was a long time until I was like, wait a second, I am not a doctor.
You came from a family of doctors.
I came from a family of doctors, but I am not one. I cannot blame myself for not diagnosing a disease. I have to let that go. You know, pervasiveness. I've lost my husband. I'm going to be terrible at work. I'm going to be a terrible mom. Everything's going to fall apart. No. I lost my husband, but I made a good point today at work, and I'm still doing the very best I can to mother those kids on my own. And permanence, as I was telling my friend just today, it feels so awful at first, and it's all individual. People process grief in different ways in different times, but time does heal. Not completely, not entirely, but...
But your whole life is not ruined.
That's right. And if you told me that day, week, months in, I didn't believe you. And I write that. Mm-hmm. I didn't believe people who told
Those
me my whole
P's
life.
Those three are so helpful. It's personalization.
It's not all your fault. Pervasive. There are things that are still good. I still had my health.
Mm-hmm.
And permanence. And one of the most counterintuitive things that happened to me was Adam saying to me long before we were working on a book, it could be way worse. You think when you're devastated, you should be looking for happy thoughts. Yep. So looking for worse seemed real. I was like, what do you mean it could be worse?
Yep.
My husband just died suddenly. He said, well, Dave could have had that same cardiac arrhythmia driving your children. I mean, you say that, and I was like, oh my God, I could have lost all three of them.
Yep.
Immediately, I was like, I'm good. Kids are alive.
Yeah.
Thinking about what could be worse is actually psychologically healthy.
I think it's a form of self-talk. I think you're telling yourself it's in a way, you're almost tricking yourself. You're telling yourself what could actually be worse, which allows you to build resilience, I would imagine, because it allows you to be grateful for things.
And gratitude for what's left.
Wow.
Gratitude for what's left.
Yeah. Which I know is a habit you began to implement in your life. I think you said it was your 2016 New Year's resolution. Can you talk a little bit about that? What did you begin to do?
Well, my kids and I did, ever since they were little, and with my husband Dave, best and worst every night at dinner. You know,
what's the best part of your day? What's
the worst part of your day? What's your worst part of your day? After Dave died, we did two things. We started praying before meals. We started doing what is called the motzi in Judaism. So it's the prayer over bread that we had only ever done before in Shabbat. Mm-hmm. We started doing it before every meal because I wanted that moment of gratitude, of being grateful for the food in front of us, not just once a week on Shabbat, but always. And we added grateful. So now it's your best, your worst, and you're grateful. And what I realized, and again, I was telling my friend this just today, is there is something to be grateful for even today.
Yes, in this moment.
In this moment.
Yes.
There's something to be grateful for, and we can help find it. We can help each other find it.
which I think allows you to become a more emotionally healthy person, because that as the sadness rises up, the gratitude rises up to almost counterbalance it in a way. Is that fair to say?
Well, we grow.
Yeah.
There are things, I mean, I would trade back all the growth and learning to get mm-hmm. Dave back in a second, but I don't have that option. Mm-hmm. But there are things about my life sitting here today that are better for having lost him. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish I could take—
Is that hard to say that?
Yeah. But I wish I could, yes, because you don't think anything good mm-hmm. should come out of it, but then why? A terrible thing happened. Why not have some good out mm-hmm. of it? Now, I wish I could take those lessons back mm-hmm. to share with him, but I can't, but I can share them with you mm-hmm. and you're sharing them with me and mm-hmm. people who are watching, and I can share them with my kids. And so I am more grateful. I will turn 50 this year. Mm. Before Dave died, I would have done what I saw all my friends do before. Oh my God, I'm 50, mm-hmm. my hair is gray, mm-hmm. I'm going old. I will never, ever make another joke about growing old because it turns out there's only two options. You either do or you don't. Dave will never turn 50, ever. Wow. And I know that turning 50 is such a gift. It's a gift from God. Mm. It's a gift from the universe. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I take for granted. Mm-hmm. And so that gratitude I will have on my birthday, that is a gift. And it is a gift from deep, deep, deep loss.
Yeah. I love this quote. I wanted to read it because one of you give these, here are all these forms of post-traumatic growth. And one of them is this. You said post-traumatic growth is finding greater meaning in life. It's a stronger sense of purpose rooted in a belief that one's existence has significance. And then you quote Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor, who said, in some way, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning. And I think that's absolutely beautiful. That's the story of redemption that faith offers, that in some ways God is using your hurt to help other people. And I'm sure you've seen that in so many different ways, like you've even talked about today.
Yeah, in so many ways. And I think that's right. It's that when we suffer, and lots of people suffer, right? You've seen it.
Sure.
I mean, we suffer because we lose people. We mm-hmm. suffer because we lose love. We suffer because we lose freedom. Mm-hmm. We suffer because we lose dreams. What do you do with it? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, bad things happen to everyone. And the only question is, how are we going to handle it? Mm. And finding meaning. So for me, there's meaning in writing this book and the Option B communities we formed on Facebook and other places so that people can come together. I think people also, in many ways, have a deeper attachment to religion. And that definitely happened to me. Mm-hmm. I was raised Jewish. Mm-hmm. It was an important part of my growing up. But I think I became more spiritually aware, cognizant, and aligned. Mm-hmm. Through what was the ultimate loss.
Yeah. Grief is different for every person. And I learned that through what you've written, that let the person decide. I think you called it the platinum mm-hmm. rule. The golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do. But the platinum rule is do for them what they would want done for them. So asking them, hey, is this, are you ready to come back? Would you like to come back? I assume that's what
that's
you mean
right.
by that.
And no, you don't know.
Yeah.
So one thing I realized is how many mistakes I had made with friends going through hardship before when I realized this.
Yeah.
I think, again, people are afraid to say something. I would say something once and then not bring it up again.
Yeah.
And now it's really different. And, you know, I've never had cancer. Mm-hmm. I have lots of friends who've had it. I no longer think I know. I literally say to them, can you give me some advice? I want to be there for you in every way possible.
Wow.
I want to make sure you're not going through this alone. What can I do? Yep. And then be specific.
Yep.
Can I bring dinner to your house?
Yep, yep, yep.
Can I babysit your kids while you're going for treatment?
Yep.
Do you want to go come over?
Yep.
Watch a movie on my couch? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, get specific, mm-hmm. but ask.
I love your question.
Do you want to talk about it a lot? Do you want to talk about it not at all?
When you said, what do you not want on a burger? Which I think
Correct.
Is fantastic.
Like,
tell
correct.
Me what you don't want, because I'm going to bring you one, whether you want it or not.
It's one of my favorite stories. So in here, we have a story of my friend and Facebook colleague, an amazing, amazing family, Dan Levy and his amazing wife. They lost a child. Mm. And they were in the hospital for many months before that child passed away. Yes, it's devastating. And they had a friend who texted and said, I'm in the lobby for a hug, whether or not you want one or not. Like, I'm here for an hour, come down or not, but I'm here. Mm. You know, the other friend showed up and said, what do you not want on a burger? Because I will be bringing a burger.
That line.
A friend of my sister's who had a child, mm-hmm. who had her daughter's teacher's child, mm-hmm. got cancer, and she had read the book. And she said before she read the book, she would have done nothing. Mm-hmm. It's her daughter's teacher's child. Like, she's knows the teacher, but she's not close. But she read the book, so she bought a big stuffed animal, mm-hmm. and she went to the hospital and said, I'm here. I have a stuffed animal for your daughter. I can leave it in the lobby or come up. The teacher said right away, please come up. So she went upstairs. Sorry, I cannot talk about this without crying. She went upstairs, gave that four-year-old the big stuffed animal. Teacher standing behind crying. And in that whole hour she was there, no one showed up. We don't have, everyone thinks that someone else is closer
That's
with the person.
Yeah.
We don't have enough friends from first grade to take care of us through these things. Show up.
Yeah.
Show up with the stuffed animal, show up with a card, show up with a hug, but ask people, do you want me to be there? With no imposition, I'm here.
Cheryl, that's beautiful. Any final thoughts that you would say to a leader, maybe a younger leader who's trying to figure out, okay, I've been through some hard pain and I'm trying to grow from it, I'm trying to get better. What are some things they could start doing today? You mentioned gratitude. Is there anything else that they could implement in their life to begin to process that pain in a way that would allow them to bounce forward?
I think gratitude. I kept a journal, which I talked about in there. At first, when I was trying to rebuild my confidence, I wrote down three things I did well.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, the list was not a very good one. Made tea. Got through two meetings without crying. Mm. Successfully put my daughter to bed. Mm. Read story. Mm. She was seven. Wasn't that hard to read a story? But the list got better, you know? And then after I knew I could get through it, knew I could be a mother, knew I could get through my job, I replaced it with moments of joy. So it depends where you are, but three moments of joy, like moments where you were like, these are moments where I can be grateful. I also think, and I think you said it earlier, that leadership and the ability to touch others comes from an intellectual pace, but even more from an emotional place.
Mm.
Share. Don't have to be open. Not everyone wants to talk all the time. You don't have to cry in meetings, even though I definitely did and still do sometimes. But share who you are.
Wow.
And that means the pain too. And people will trust you and believe in you and learn from you even more. And you'll learn from them.
Wow.
When I shared my pain, other people shared theirs. And I learned so much more. One of the other ways we have post-traumatic growth is deeper relationships. I didn't think I could be closer with my kids. We are closer. I didn't think I could be closer with my sister and brother. And Dave's brother is like brother to me now. We are closer. We are bound together in these experiences.
And that's one of the growths from post-traumatic loss. So can you finish this conversation by telling the story? I hope it's okay to share. But the moment where you're upstairs crying, you have this huge meeting downstairs with, I think it was a bunch of some of the
clients.
Most important Facebook clients, and your son gave you some really important advice that I think really ties into what you're saying about being willing to be openly vulnerable and emotional in a way that helps you actually process it with other people.
Yeah, I was hosting a client dinner or something I did rarely and did much more rarely then, and for what, I had gone to a school assembly that day. And I was sitting there, and I overheard someone say to someone that they were upset their husband was missing the school assembly because he was away on a business trip. And it didn't mean to hurt my feelings. There's nothing wrong with saying that, but I was just despondent. And I was like, my husband will never be at anything again. And I went home, and I could not stop crying. I was upstairs in my room, could not stop crying. All my clients are arriving, and my son came up, and I said, I've got to go downstairs, but I can't stop crying. And he just said, Mom, just go down there and be yourself. And if they see you cry, they'll probably like you better. So I tried to stop crying, but I went downstairs and I couldn't. And I said, my son said it was okay. And they said it was. And you know, a bunch of them had experienced some form of loss too. So many people are walking around. You are sitting next to someone right now who's experiencing something they might not have shared. Share yours and they'll share too.
That's powerful. Well, and thank you for Facebook, because that's one of the benefits of Facebook. I mean, the post that you made 30 days after Dave's death, I think allowed so many people to be able to connect with you in a way, to be able to share their own loss in a way that 20 years ago, we didn't have that platform to be able to do that. So thank you for the benefit that you're adding to our community and to communities all over the world.
No, I really believe that. I mean, there are so many faith-based groups that are on Facebook. There are so many groups around loss and around challenges and around diseases, but also around birthdays and donating to save lives and the best moments of our lives. And I do believe that connection we can share as people really helps us. I did this post on Facebook 30 days in, which I didn't realize would be as broad as it was and go as viral as it did, but it did. But on that post, people said, you know, things like, I just lost one of two twins. I'm in the NICU. and I'm going to go in and try to give that second, a surviving child, a wonderful life. Like, I felt so close to that woman who I will never meet. Mm-hmm. But that's the power of connection, of building community and being there for one another.
And the power of being vulnerable and sharing your own story with other people, which I've never thought about it in that way, that in a way that really does help you process it. It helps you. I think it's easier to think about, well, this certainly helps other people, but to think about this is actually good for me to share, that that's a way to begin to emotionally process some of that pain to help you bounce forward. Is that fair?
Yeah, and to feel like you're doing something with it. Mm-hmm. It is there, but if you help someone else, you know, I didn't know a lot of people who had lost husbands, or especially as young as I did, but the few I did, they really showed up for me, and, you know, we try to pay it forward. I'm so grateful to them, and this book was Maya and Adam trying to give that to more people.
Well, it's a gift, so thank you. Cheryl, thank you for doing this. Thanks for your time. I know your time is very valuable, and this has been a real pleasure for me, and I think it's going to help a lot of people, so thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you came to Facebook, even on a rainy day.
Thanks.
I love that line that she says at the end, that, you know, one of the benefits of helping other people is you at least feel like you're doing something with it. And sitting there talking to Cheryl was just such a, it was such a helpful conversation for me, because it's where I started to really crystallize some thoughts around the idea that yes, suffering is awful. Yes, trials and trouble and all of the struggles that every single one of us has are awful. But learning to get to use that to help others, that really is where the joy is found. It's where the redemption happens, where life gets to come from this horrific loss or death or rejection or disruption or whatever it may be. And that really is what I hope, that's what I hope you walk away with today, is that your struggle, your trouble, your trial, that it actually can have a purpose. And it can actually be something that you see as a way to help other people. I don't know if you'll ever get to a point, I don't know if I'll ever get to a point to say that the worst thing that has ever happened to you, the worst thing that's ever happened to me, is actually a gift. That's really difficult to say that. But when we start to see God use it in other people's lives, I think that's when we start to realize that, there's some meaning here. There's a purpose here. There's something better that can happen on the other side because of this. And that really is what, that's my hope for you. That's my hope for myself. I love Cheryl and Adam's definition of resilience. I tried to read it there at the beginning of that interview, but we just got into so many other topics that I never got to come back to it. But they define resilience as the speed and strength at which you respond to adversity. The speed and the strength at which you respond to those difficult things, the disruption, the rejection, as we talked about last week. We've been using this definition that resilience is bouncing back from disruption or adversity or rejection, but it's the speed and strength. I love that idea that you can get faster and you can get stronger. It's a muscle that can be worked out. It's a muscle that can grow. It's not just this, it's not this fixed state. No, it's something that we all can get better at, and we can help each other get better. We can actually be more resilient for someone else. That's the idea for today. And so what I want to do is I just want to read a passage from something the Apostle Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians. He knew a thing or two about hard times. He knew a thing or two about difficult situations. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, at the very beginning of this letter that he wrote, he gives us this same idea. That, hey, you have been given something from God in your darkest hour, at the worst time. God gave you something, but it wasn't just for you. He gave you something that was meant for you to then give away to someone else. Here's the way it begins. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3. He wrote, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort." He gives God three different titles there in that one little verse. He says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion." And then he calls him the God of all comfort. Don't you love that title? that he is the God of all comfort. If we were to just take a moment and say, how many of you have experienced the God of all comfort in some really dark hour in the middle of the night? I would imagine we would have thousands of hands that would go up, because we have all experienced, hopefully we have all experienced the God of all comfort comforting us in those times. And the way he does it through prayer, right? He does it through his presence, but then he also does it through people. That it's amazing how the answer to our prayers usually come in the form of another person. That I can be the answer to your prayer and you can be the answer to my prayer. I can be the conduit that God uses to help you, and you can be the conduit that God uses to help comfort me. It's the way he designed us to operate. He says in verse 4, he says that the God of all comfort who comforts us in all our troubles. And then he gives these two words that are so important, because they really, they should be a mile marker, a post sign to say, hey, I'm about to tell you why. I'm about to give you the purpose. He says, who comforts us in all of our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble, so that we can comfort others who are in the middle of trouble with the same comfort, with the comfort that we ourselves received from God. So he gives us this very clear picture. It's a very simple picture, right? That basically in the middle of your darkest time and your suffering and your trial and your trouble, that God has a way of comforting you, but it's not just for you. No, he gives you that gift so that then you can go and provide that same comfort to someone else in the middle of theirs. It's amazing how God decided to create us as beings that need to be interconnected to each other, because it's how he actually meets our needs. It's how he actually provides for us. Paul continues and he fleshes this out. He gives us another way of thinking about this. Verse 5, he says, for just as we share abundantly in the sufferings of Christ, so also our comfort abounds through Christ. Look at those two words, abundantly and abounds, these huge, large, lavish words, that we love the abounding comfort, we don't love the abundant suffering, right? But he says that they're proportionate in a way, that in the same way that we share in this large amount of suffering that Jesus went through, we share in Christ's suffering. Paul knew exactly what that was like, as gruesome, as awful as Jesus' death on the cross was, as awful as his suffering on earth, being rejected, being betrayed, having his own reputation diminished. In the same way that Jesus suffered, Paul himself had his own suffering. Paul knew what it was like to be betrayed by friends, to have family members turn their back on him, to have friends leave him. He knew what it was like to be shipwrecked. If you want a picture of Paul's suffering, go read Acts 27, the last chapter in Acts. It's the saddest, most awful thing, because he's shipwrecked on this island that he didn't even wish to be on. They're creating a fire out of some old logs. He reaches his hand to go put something in the fire. You remember what happens? A snake comes and bites him. I remember reading that thinking, boy, Paul, you can't catch a break. I mean, that is just it just continued to happen over and over and over again. He knew what it was like to share abundantly in the sufferings of Christ, and so do you. On different levels and different ways, you know what it's like to share in those sufferings as well. You've lost loved ones. You've experienced job loss. You know what it's like to be left out. You know what it's like to be betrayed. And he says, in the same way that we share abundantly in those sufferings, he says, and so also our comfort abounds as well through Jesus. That yes, we have this huge amount of suffering, but we also have this huge amount of comfort that God has provided to us through the empathy and understanding of Jesus. He continues in the next verse, verse 6, he says, for if we are distressed, if you're feeling distressed, this is for you. You might not use that word, but he says, if we are distressed, it is for your comfort and salvation. So if I'm distressed, he's saying it's going to be for your comfort and your salvation. Again, he shows us this picture. God's going to comfort me in my suffering so I can comfort you. God comforts you in your suffering so you can comfort me. He says, and if we're comforted, it's for your comfort as well, which produces, look at these two words, it produces patient endurance. I think that's essentially what resilience is patient endurance. Nobody woke up today and thought, man, I would love to figure out how to be more patiently enduring today. That would really be great. No, we want to avoid pain, right? We want the fast lane. We want the shortcut. We want to know the easy way. But he says sometimes to get to be the person, to become the person that I want you to become, you've got to go through the suffering. You've got to hit it head on. You've got to walk right through it so that you can become a more resilient person, a patiently enduring person. That's God's wish for you. It's his hope for you. But the hard thing is it comes with that suffering word that we don't like. And that's what Paul says. He says, if we're distressed, it's for your comfort. If we're comforted, it's for your comfort, which produces in you patient endurance of the same sufferings we suffer. And then in verse 7, he gives us this, just a huge encouragement that I think is worth looking at because of how powerful this is. He says, and our hope for you is firm. Our hope for you is firm. In other words, you're going to be okay. You're going to make it. In fact, I'm going to see to it that you make it. Have you ever had somebody tell you, you know, instead of just saying to you, hey, I hear about your situation. I just want to let you know, I think you're going to get through it. That's great. I'm going to tell you what's even more powerful. Hey, I heard about your situation and I just want to let you know, we're going to get through this. I'm going to be right there with you. I'm going to help you. I'm going to be walking with you. I'm going to be holding your hand if you need me to. I'll help pay your bills if you need me to. Whatever I can do, I'll bring you a meal. I am going to be there with you. We're going to get through this together. It's what Paul is telling the people that were reading this. Hey, I just want to let you know, yeah, it seems bad. Yeah, this might be hard, but our hope for you is firm. And I believe that he'd say the same thing for you today, that no matter what you're dealing with, no matter what you're going through, our hope for you, it's firm. We believe that you can make it. Everything's going to be okay. And he tells us why. He says, because we know that just as you share in our sufferings, so also you share in our comfort. Yeah, it's been hard, but I'm going to be there for you. So I'm going to give you just four simple thoughts from reading a passage like this. The first one is that you can't bounce back alone. God wants you to learn how to bounce back. That's what resilience is, bouncing back from disruption, adversity, rejection. You can't bounce back alone. No, it requires a team of people around you that will help you bounce back when you feel like you can't. And if that's true, then this is also true, that there are other people in your life that can't bounce back without you. That the only way they're going to bounce back is to have you in their life, to have you with them, to have you alongside of them. You can't do it alone, and others around you, they need you to be able to bounce back. The third idea is this, that there's someone somewhere that needs your struggle. Someone around you, they need your struggle. They need to know what you've been through, how you made it through, how it felt. Last idea is this, that your suffering might just be your superpower. The hardest thing, the worst thing, the most awful thing that's happened to you, it might just be that superpower in you that makes you who you are, that makes you as great as you are, that allows you to help other people in a way that only you could do it. It's the way God works. This is what redemption is. This word redemption is, it's a spiritual word, it's a religious word, but it's such a beautiful idea. It's really what God uniquely can do in our lives. The idea is that, yes, something bad happened. No, we would not want to go through it again. Of course, you would not wish it on anyone else. But redemption is the idea that even in death, God can bring life. God can do something good through the most awful thing that's happened to you. I don't know where else people find that. But Jesus gives us the most beautiful picture of this. Because that Good Friday was the worst day imaginable. And then 3 days later, here we are celebrating the resurrection of Jesus because God brought something good out of death. And God can bring something good out of your death as well. He can bring something good out of your loss as well. That your suffering, as Viktor Frankl said in that quote that Cheryl references in her book, Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor, he said, in most cases, very often, your suffering ceases to be suffering the moment it finds meaning, the moment it finds meaning, the moment it finds purpose. That when your suffering finds an outlet to help someone else, it actually turns into something that's being redeemed for good. Do you wish it would have never happened? Of course. Do you still hate the moment that it happened? Of course. But your suffering can cease to be suffering the moment it finds meaning, the moment it finds purpose. That's my hope for you. That's really the idea for the day, is that your life was never meant to just be in a self-help section. I love that line that she said. I don't want this book to be a book for self-help. I want this to be a help others book. Your life was meant to be a help other kind of life. And as soon as you learn how to bounce back from your own stuff, as soon as God begins to build up that muscle of resilience in you, you'll find the outlet of helping others do the same thing. God wants to help you build your own resilience, but he also wants you to help others become more resilient as well. Resilience is a team sport. You can't do this alone. And someone needs your struggle as well. And your struggle might just be, your suffering might just be your greatest superpower. So here's what I would love to do as we end today, is I would love to just take a moment to practice what we're talking about. There's some of you that you're dealing with something right now that has been rough. Maybe it's job loss, maybe the loss of someone, maybe a health diagnosis, maybe betrayal from friends, maybe something difficult that feels like it's been difficult to bounce back from. We want to practice learning resilience together. And so what I would love to do is I would love to just invite you, if that's you, if you would say, yeah, I've got something right now that I'm dealing with at all of our churches and all our auditoriums, I would love for you to just raise your hand. Just let us know. Just tell us that's me. I've got something going on right now. That is really brave of you. That's awesome. And then if you're open to it, and if you're not at this point, I don't know how you're going to tell me that you're not, but I'm going to pray. And then I would love to just invite the people that are around you to just put their hand on your shoulder and just let you know that, hey, we're praying for you. We're praying with you. We want to help be people that are helping you build resilience even in this difficult time. So as I pray, I would love to just invite you. Let's pray for the people around us and let's be resilient together. Heavenly Father, I can't even begin to imagine what people are wrestling with and dealing with. If we were to pass a microphone, there would be all kinds of stories. It would be heartbreaking. It would probably leave us speechless. It would be surprising how difficult just the people sitting around us, how difficult the situations and circumstances are. But we trust that you are the God of all comfort. You are the Father of compassion. And so even now in this moment, we just pray that you would provide that kind of compassion, that kind of comfort that only you can provide, the supernatural kind. I pray that it would match our suffering, that it would be proportionate. As deep as the hurt, as deep as the pain, that the comfort from you would be just as deep. It would be just as rich. God, I pray that we would be a show-up kind of church. That we would be a what-do-you-not-want-on-your-burger kind of church. Even when we don't know what to do, that we would find something that we can do. To show up and be vulnerable and be real, but also to comfort others with the same comfort that we have been comforted with. So that we can build our own resilience, so that we can help build and fight for others. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for your love. Thanks for your kindness. Thank you for your grace. And God, thank you for your comfort. And we pray all of this in his name. Amen.